Blog Talk Radio.
Another episode hosted by the Vouch System. Today we are honored to be joined by Mr. Armand Mosley. Armand is very passionate about helping young adults cultivate and authenticate their relationship with Christ. Armand is the author of a recently or published book entitled Rededication, A Story of Sex, Repentance, and Restoration. He's also the founding partner member of the Kingdom Workshops LLC, which seeks to reach out to the young people for them to fulfill the purposes that God has instilled upon them. Armand is a native of, like I said, Huntsville. He lives in Pennsylvania right now. He has a lovely wife, Nneka. Thank you for joining us today, Armand. How are you?
Doing good. Thanks for having me.
Great. Well, I want to kind of just jump in there. I actually a book in a day and a half,
wow.
And I didn't get through to the workbook, but I couldn't put it down when I get a copy of it. I really couldn't put it down. I shared a lot of the experiences I think that you kind of shared in the book, and I think a lot of young men across the country, kind of maybe lived that life as well. But I want to ask you, who's the woman of noble character this far greater than rubies that you speak of in the book?
That woman will be my wife, Nneka.
Okay, awesome. Now, Armand, why did you decide to title the book Rededication, A Story of Sex, Repentance, and Restoration?
Good question. I think the main reason why is because the book is really about, at the end of the day, it's about rededication. See, for me, the book begins pretty much, once we start the first chapter, it begins with my baptism. So you see that I had a relationship with Christ early on in my life. And then from that point of baptism, we take a journey. And in that journey, I make indiscretions, I make wrong choices. And then as you come to the conclusion of the book, you see me turning back around and coming back to Christ. So the focus of the book is just around rededicating myself to Christ. And I want to make sure that was the emphasis, because I think a lot of times people believe once they've kind of stepped out in the wrong way, that they can't come back home, so to speak. So I wanted to make that the focus. And then the subtitle, it really is a story about sex. It's a story about repentance. It's a story ultimately about restoration. I didn't want to leave that restoration piece off because, I made the indiscretion of sex. I repented. I asked for forgiveness. Then ultimately, God did restore me. And I think that's a key piece for people to understand.
Okay. So is it more or less, each chapter of your life is maybe one part of sex and then repentance and restoration, or just kind of chronicles your entire journey?
Yeah, I think if you did if you were to do a breakdown of the book, there's buckets of chapters that would fall into each of those subtitles. So sex would probably cover the early stages and the collegiate piece. And then once I get out of college, you start to convert from the story of sex into the story of repentance. And then the last few chapters, you go from a story of repentance into a story of restoration.
Okay. Now, in the book, you actually described a 40-day spiritual journey that you undertook. What was the purpose of that, and how did that impact your journey?
Sure. After graduating college, I had a pretty good job. For all intents and purposes, I had a good life, but I found myself still feeling empty. And so, I felt that it had something to do with God. I don't think I was immediately ready to acknowledge that's what it was, but there had been a lot of talk about the book Purpose Driven Life by Rick Warren at the time. And so finally, kind of by happenstance, I ran into the book and I said, okay, I'll go ahead and get the book and see what it's about. Maybe this book will help me identify what this missing piece is, where this void is coming from, what my purpose, so to speak, is. Because again, my job and the other things I had in my life weren't fulfilling me the way that I thought they should. And so that's what kind of drove me to that point of reading the book. Now, the book takes you on a 40-day journey of a chapter. He suggests that you read one chapter a day. And so instead of reading the book and still doing everything I was already doing, I decided to say, you know what, if I'm really going to try to identify where the source of this void is, what God may be trying to tell me, let me, quote-unquote, give up some things. So let me stop, you know, fornicating. Let me stop going to clubs. Let me stop drinking. Let me stop listening to rap and hip-hop music, to, you know, things that are negative influences, as I understand them to be, on my life. So I gave up those things, quote-unquote, again. I use the word gave up loosely because I probably shouldn't have been doing them in the first place. But I gave those things up for 40 days, and I read the book, and the, it had an immediate impact, because the reality is after I did that, whether I acknowledged it or not, I never really went back to doing things in the same fashion for a consistent period of time again. So that was kind of really the turning point. Again, I don't think I recognized that the outcome would be that I would, you know, eventually live a life of celibacy, but I was just looking for purpose. And so, lo and behold, that's kind of what sparked the initial piece.
Wow. Like, and speaking about celibacy, actually, you took the vow of celibacy prior to marriage. Exactly when did you begin that vow of celibacy? How long did it last, and how difficult was it?
Well, you know, technically, I guess I could say I began it in probably the, I think, around Thanksgiving of 2004. And that lasted for about a year, about 18 months. And then I went back to try. I tried. I got mad at God. I felt like, you know, hey, here I am not having sex, and you're not showering me with gifts. You know, I thought if I gave up sex that I'd be a millionaire by the time, you know, a year was over. You know, and I'm like, hey, nobody else is doing this, but God, you have to reward me. You know, I thought you were a rewarder of those who faithfully seek you. What's up, you know? And so when I found out, you know, when I felt that he wasn't giving me my just due, I said, well, forget this. I got something for you, God. I'm going to go back and do exactly what you told me not to do. And I tried to do that, but it didn't work. And, you know, a few months later, I finally kind of really did acquiesce in the fall of 06. And that was when I truly committed to it. But then what I learned is after, from that point forward, because once I truly committed to it, I started to dig into the Word to really get a better understanding of what God's intent was around that issue and tried to build my relationship with Him. So when I had done it from 04 into the summer of 06, you know, I hadn't, I didn't really do a lot of Bible study. I just was abstaining from sexual intercourse. What I learned from the fall of 06 forward is that, you know, wow, okay, so a lot of things I thought were permissible were not. You know, so I'm just sitting here just not putting it in, but, you know, oral sex, you know, fondling, all these things are inconsistent with what, how God intends for men and women to have relationships outside of the context of marriage. So once I came to understand that, I really felt embarrassed because I'm up here proclaiming celibacy for all this period of time, when the reality is I wasn't anything but just not having intercourse. And so once I came to understand that, you know, I felt remorseful, but I was glad that I did come to that understanding. And so officially I would say from spring 07 until I got married was when I was fully celibate, no sexually impure actions.
Wow. It was quite the journey. I guess you said you initially began in 04. Prior to that, you were a college student at Howard University. And you described kind of your vision of entering college, like probably a lot of young men, as a time to, you know, quote unquote, sow your royal oats. But deep inside, you knew you were doing something wrong. So, you know, why did you continue to, like, fornicate and if you knew it was wrong and you know, disobey God in that way?
You know, I mean, the age-old wisdom piece of, you know, if you know better, you do better. That should apply, right? But it didn't, and I think it's, you know, I think it's kind of a situation where, at least for me, you know, I think I wanted to keep up with everybody else. But no matter what I felt internally, what I saw externally, was that people were really getting a lot of enjoyment out of this. People were doing it as carefree as they wanted to. And so I wanted to feel that same way. You know, I mean, it's lonely to be on a college campus as a male and not be having sex. You know, you don't have when you guys come back from the club and you, or the next morning when y'all share stories of what happened the night before. You have
right,
to have a source.
Right.
You got to be able to contribute to that discussion, or you know, you're not going to be allowed to come into that circle too much more. So,
it's not
explicitly stated. It's implied, though. I mean, everybody kind of knows, like, you can only come to the seat of the table so many times without having something to contribute. And so I think part of that, you know, I guess you can say that's ultimately peer pressure, but I don't think it's explicit peer pressure. I think it's just kind of what in Rome do, the Romans do, you know, guilty by association. And so I think I let my my pride and my ego eclipse the feelings that I had internally. And so I succumbed to that, the pride and ego, as opposed to yielding to what I was feeling internally.
Okay, all right. Now, let's talk about a little bit about this thing that you mentioned, your numbers in college and so forth. So probably, you know, a lot of men might also be trying to get their numbers in whatever college campus they're at right now. And for those that don't know, can you describe what the numbers were between your first circle of friends? And your friends would have ostracized you at that point if you chose not to participate in certain activities.
Can you clarify that? When you say numbers, what do you mean?
You know, you're going around trying to count how many women that you've, you know, slept with, or how many women you've hooked with, or whatever, you know.
Gotcha. Well, I mean, I think it's a huge component. You know, that's mean nobody's, I don't think anybody has a spreadsheet with people's names and the quantity beside it, but people are keeping a mental check on, you know, I think the more women you have, the more, quote-unquote, successful you are from a masculinity perspective. At least that's the perceived notion. And so, you know, I just thought that if I didn't keep up, you know, I wasn't going to be able to hang out with my boys. Or if they did keep me around, I'd be the butt of all jokes. I'd be the guy that, you know, I could never close. Or here you go again. You're too nice, you know, that type of thing. I mean, it can be a very lonely situation. So, and so that was kind of the circle of people I was around. I think the frat, and I think anybody within a fraternity can relate, that contributes to it. I mean, there's definitely some group think going on in the fraternity. So even the person with the most purest intentions coming in, you know, you can be strong-willed, but, you know, if everybody around is doing one thing, it's very difficult at that age to, you know, be the one to not do it. And so I think, I guess I was a little mentally weak at the time, and I did kind of fall in line with what everyone else was doing. But also there was an internal, there was a piece of me that wanted to do it anyway. There was some internal curiosity as well. So I was able to fulfill that piece. So it's kind of, I don't say 50-50, but it's definitely, you know, blame on both sides.
Okay. Kind of like, you know, I can show you your five friends and then you'll pretty much know the average of what your average would be, that type of thing. Now, was there coming to this moment that, like, maybe sparked an epiphany in you to change?
For me, you know, in the book, it kind of, this theme of a void keeps popping up. And so that was, I think, for me, God kind of prodding me to get my attention. The come to Jesus moment really was tied to a business venture that me and one of my friends had gone into, and things had gone awry. And you know, I always prided myself on being fairly intelligent, you know, someone who thought, you know, the sky was the limit. So to see something that I had worked so hard for and worked so hard on kind of crumble right before me was a shock to my ego, shock to pride, a shock to everything I ever knew. That was the first time in my life that I, quote-unquote, failed. And so that was, again, I processed that experience as God finally saying, okay, I've tried to nudge you, I've tried to prod you, but none of that's really gotten your full attention. So let me take something away that isn't beneficial for you anyway, and you'll see once this plays out. But let me disrupt your life enough that you have no choice but to look to me. And so when that failed, we got into some really tough financial times, and neither one of us knew how we were going to make the next month's multiple mortgages for the properties that we had. And so, you know, I tried to, at first I wanted to be mad at God, I was upset, I felt like it wasn't fair. But, you know, after a couple of weeks, a couple of months, I finally said, all right, you know what, forget it. Obviously, you're really not going to let me get by with this sex thing, so, okay, here, you have it. What do you want me to do? Because I can't do anything right now. I've tried to everything I can to solve this problem, but I just haven't been able to do it. So I grew up in the church, so I did know, you know, you get in those types of situations where to turn to, where the help comes from, and that's where I went.
Okay. All right. So it kind of changed came by choice and circumstance in a way.
Correct.
Okay. Now, what is your extent of your relationship to your boys now that you kind of live in a different way?
Well, I think initially, you know, it was definitely, well, one, you know, when you're in your 20s, in your early 20s, you know, you have friends from college, you have associates, people you're meeting when you're out in the city, hanging out, whatever you're doing, you know, you probably have too many friends anyway at that time. So when I really started to be serious about this, you know, some people fell off, some people distanced themselves from me. I wouldn't say those were my friends, I would say those were acquaintances. My friends, for the most part, you know, I think it was somewhat awkward initially because, you know, we spent a large amount of our time speaking, talking about women and the women and what we did and how we did, you know, so on and so forth. So that was a central piece to our conversation, you know. I mean, obviously we talked about career goals and aspirations and motivated each other, but there was definitely a time allotted to women. And so once I, you know, got on this this journey, I didn't have any stories to tell, and I didn't want to hear stories because, you know, it wasn't going to be beneficial for me to hear what they did with who and when, you know. So it was a little, you know, you had that quiet space on the phone sometimes, like, oh, all right, man, well, okay, man, well, take care, bro, you know what I'm saying, because it's just kind of awkward.
Right.
So when we got through that, man, and we all grew and matured anyway, you know, I think. So as time passed, you know, some of them eventually came back and, you know, inquired about the journey and attempted to walk that thing as well, you know, and did successfully for certain periods of time. So I think for the reality was, and it was interesting, is that most of my friends, they grew up in the church too. So nobody disagreed with what I was doing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think everybody at some point was convicted around it, you know, but it's just a matter of who's going to put action to it. And so I think me, you know, putting up and shutting up and actually doing it served as encouragement to them. So it really helped them to get to a point of taking self-inventory of their lives. And some of them, like I said, you know, recommitted themselves or rededicated themselves as well. So, but today we're good buddies. I mean, everybody knows what I'm about, you know, and so it's not no awkwardness at all.
Okay. Now, did anybody in your crew kind of follow up on your path, your journey, or, hey, you know, I see how this changed Armand's life, you know, let me, you know, maybe see how maybe it can change.
I would say two people in particular. One of them you know very well, you know, one of my friends.
Yeah.
You know, we had a conversation early in the journey when I still didn't even really know what it meant. We had a conversation about it, and, you know, it was funny because me and him were probably we were associates while we were at Howard. But after we had that conversation about this, you know, this conviction around sexual sin, over time, by the time I actually had fully got vested into this journey, he was fully vested in the journey as well. And then we became really, really close. And now he's probably one of my best friends. So, you know, it's funny where I may have lost some friends along the way, I gained some too.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. I was reading about that part in the book. I was like, this kind of sounds kind of familiar, this guy. Why do you think, I mean, you had pretty much, you know, a successful career, I guess, and you graduated college, you know, you had a, you know, professional job out there, and you were single black male. So, you know, in society, probably your family size, like you said in the book, you'd made it, you know, for a black man, you know. But why do you think that, you know, a lot of young black males feel that they should enjoy the fruits of their sex, of their success, I'm sorry, without seeking to commit to one woman?
I mean, it's a very interesting question. I think that, you know, part of it is how we define success. And I think, unfortunately, at least definitely in the black community, part of being successful is having a pick of women. You know, it's rarely deemed successful for a black man to be married at 22 or 23. You know what? I mean, most other black men would be like, oh, man, you know, he's wilding out. You know, he's rushing into things. Like, man, you sure you want to do that, man? Like, you're too young for that. You know, we don't look at marriage as a point within the success journey, I think. And so I think that's part of the problem. So I think we need a paradigm shift to even get more people to be more accepting of that. I mean, I was 28 when I got married. And, you
right.
know, I mean, I was the first person in my close circle, with the exception of a few, but
mm-hmm.
I was one of the first people in my group to get married, you know, and still since then, none of them have gotten married. So, you know, that kind of goes to show just how little priority marriage has, I think. I think it's something like, okay, let me do everything I can do. Let me make all the money I can make and splurge and spoil myself, both on women and with things. And then once I'm bored and I'm tired and I'm kind of run that course, then I'll shift and focus on finding one woman to marry.
I see. Okay. Well, you know what I kind of really liked about the way you described your wife, Nneka, you know, to the readers. It kind of make me as a man, you know, pray all to find the woman to get married to. But you know, that's probably not the case with a lot of young men. And why do you think there's so many people out there that are shying away from marriage now?
I mean, I think it's responsibility. You know, so I think in general people shirk responsibility as often as they can. And I think we haven't done a good job of really depicting marriage in a positive light. You know, most of the images we see of marriage are failed ones or, you know, a boring, dry existence. And so I think that's where, you know, it's incumbent upon, you know, people who are married to share their story, to be transparent, to be open with people and let people know the joys of marriage. You know, it's definitely great. You know, I don't have any qualms about it. I enjoy every day, you know, being with my best friend, you know, a woman that I love, that I'm attracted to physically, mentally, spiritually. So there's no, I'm like, I can't imagine a better situation. It's like, man, I should have got on this page earlier. You know, I could have enjoyed even more time. You know, so I think it's the fear of the unknown. It's like, well, I know most men, you know, we probably say, well, I know kind of doing the dating thing can be extremely fun, but it has an empty ending. You know, but I don't know anything about the marriage thing. I don't really know what that looks like, and I can't just try that out, quote unquote. So let me just stay away from it until I'm absolutely sure. You know, I think people are afraid to fail too, right? We've seen so many marriages fail. People don't want to jump right into it, but I think, you know, we just have to look at it differently and really, to your point, you know, if you're being prayerful about it and just trusting that God's going to lead you to the right woman at the right time, you know, there's nothing to be afraid of.
Right. No, I totally agree there. You described actually Nneka had, you know, some kind of, you know, a problem with you not showing affection early on in your relationship to her. But can you describe, you know, the difference between affection and sex for the young people out there?
Well, you know, I think I talk about in the book, the biggest challenge was for me was to learn how to be affectionate without being sexual. So, you know, affectionate can be holding hands, you know, hugging, a kiss on the cheek, you know, looking them in the eyes and telling them that you love them. You know, I mean, you can, you know, a stroke of the hair, you know, rubbing their hand. I mean, again, these are things to show that you have feelings for someone. Sexual would be, you know, rubbing on the hand with the intent to move from hand to arm, from arm to breast. You know what I'm saying? Sexual would be, well, I don't want to kiss you on the cheek. I want a tongue kiss, you know. Sexual would be instead of hugging, you're groping. So I think most of the things that, you know, most of the gateways to the sexual activities for me in the past, and I've been like, if I hug someone, I was hugging them because I was, you know, eventually wanting to have sex with them, and I was hoping that if I hugged them, maybe I could kiss them on the neck and then get something started, you know. If I kissed someone, it wasn't a kiss to show affection, it was a kiss to kind of get things started. So to break my mind out of that, saying, okay, well, I need to still be able to show this woman affection, but it's not, I'm not doing these things with an end goal. I'm doing these things to let her know that I care about it, not to get her blood boiling so that we can go jump in the bed. You know, so that was a big shift for me. And so at first I just did nothing. I'm like, well, since we're not having sex, I'm not going to do anything. And I realized early on that wasn't going to work, you know, and that I had to learn to distinguish between the two.
Right. It's a very good point there because, you know, still humans, and we still have to show each other, I guess, in your relationship, that I care about you, I love you, you know, having to have sex in a relationship. How did it feel to you now, you know, going into your relationship with NECA, that she'd been praying for you every day, even though God had not kind of revealed to either of you that you were each?
Well, man, it's crazy. You know, it's definitely crazy, but it's one of the things where you just have a big sigh of relief. It's like, wow, okay, it's like a confirmation. Like, mm-hmm. This is the type of woman I want. You know, somebody who's praying for her husband before she even meets him, you know, that's powerful. So you feel like, for me, I felt, excuse me, I felt like, man, I'm in good hands. Like, God really hooked me up, you know. I got to pray and win.
Right.
You know, so
right.
It's like, I can't. And that's how, you know, for me, it's kind of funny, because if I went and picked my wife, I know I would have done as well. You know, I would have picked the wrong thing,
mm-hmm.
you know, for whatever reason. I would have picked something that, for Armand, the flesh, seemed to make sense. But, you know, to really let God lead me to the one, you know, that's really been helpful, and I've seen the benefits of that. And so even, you know, I know there's going to be trials down the road. Every marriage has them. Thankfully, we haven't yet, but I believe that when those trials come, the fact that I know that God put her in my life for a reason is more the reason to stay the course. You know, whereas if I felt like I made the decision, then I feel like I can also reverse the decision. But really feeling like, no, this is God is ordaining this thing. So the only way this gets reversed is if he comes down from heaven and splits us apart. And we know that ain't happening. So it's a good thing, man. It's a really good thing.
Okay, awesome. Now, when you and NECA do decide to have children, what do you think that you can do to alleviate them from experiencing some of the same pains that you encountered, you know, throughout life?
I think it's just transparency, man. I'm big on transparency, and I think you saw as you read the book, you know, I'm pretty open in the book, and I don't pull any punches. And while I wanted to, because I wanted to protect my own self, I'm like, man, people gonna have a lot of opinions about me after reading this. But then I realized it wasn't my story to hide, you know, and I think the big thing with our kids in the future is telling them, you know, hey, look, this is what mommy and daddy did. Like, we made mistakes. But being very vivid and very transparent for age, you know, and obviously being age appropriate. Because I think the thing that happens is that, you know, kids are often too many times left to ambiguity as it relates to their parents. So they know what sex is, and they know what sex looks like, and they know the average age people normally have sex based on their friends, what they see on TV, and other stuff. But they've never heard that story from their parents. So they don't know if that's wrong or right, or really what the consequences could be. You know, when your parents can tell you real examples, like, hey, you know, I had a good friend who, you know, contracted HIV from while he was in college. You know, I had a good friend, you know, that did this, or daddy contracted this, or dad was lucky that he didn't, but as a result, he still went through this because he was trying to fill a void with women. You know, hey, daughter, you know, I've been that guy to tell a woman whatever she wanted to hear, to have sex with her, and it didn't work out for her or me. You know, I'm not making this up. I'm not trying to be cute. You know, so I think the more we can be honest, you know, her mom can tell her about the emotions she had when a guy just had sex with her and left. And let her know multiple times, like, hey, when I was 20, this, or when I was 17, 18, like, whatever age it is, I think when you can be that relatable and that transparent, children appreciate that, because now it's not abstract. It's like, okay, my dad told me when he was here, he did this, and this is what happened to him. So now I have reason to believe that maybe I shouldn't do it, versus hearing about it from some, you know, some speaker who comes in at a school. I think parents have a lot more power than that.
Okay, awesome. Now we have about a minute left in the show here. Just brief. What's the next phase of life hold for you, and then how can, you know, people get a copy of this great book that you've written?
I mean, the next phase is just continue to build my marriage, man. You know, I mean, prayerfully, you know, we want to have a family in the near future, so, you know, we're going to look to that and start preparing for that piece. And just continue to be used by God. You know, I think whether through this book, I have some other book ideas in mind, so just continue to be, you know, yield to him and ultimately do his purpose in my life. As far as getting the book, you can get it on Amazon.com. You can go to www.kingdomworkshops.com. You can get it from there. You can email me at info@kingdomworkshops.com as well to request the book. If you do it that way, I can sign a copy and send it to you. So it's on Barnes & Noble as well. It's available in the ebook format for the Nook, Kindle and iPad. So, you know, it's pretty much everywhere books are sold.
Awesome, awesome. Well, you know, thank you for joining us today, and thank you for being a guest on the show. I really appreciate you coming on and sharing some of your thoughts and, you know, your book and sharing all that with us. And, you know, I wish you the best.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate the time.
Awesome, awesome. Have a great one.
You too.
Well, that wraps up another episode of Each One, Reach One. We were honored to be joined by Armand Mosley today, who shared quite a bit. You can pick up his book, like he said, on Amazon. You could email him directly, you know, or you can email me, and I can get you, you know, connected with him to pick up a copy of the book. But until next time, have a great one.